Today, we're diving deep into topics that touch the lives of so many of us: metabolic health, weight loss, and how to truly take control of our health as we age. Our journey to wellness isn't just about shedding pounds. It's about understanding the underlying factors that contribute to our overall health, from the food we eat to how our bodies process energy. Today, we'll explore the power of lifestyle changes, the impact of diet and exercise, even touch on the latest medical advancements aimed at helping us achieve our health goals. Whether you're looking to revamp your health or seeking motivation to start, this episode is packed with actionable advice for living your healthiest life after 50. Stay tuned for an enlightening conversation that could very well change the way you think about health and aging. Hello, and welcome to the Over 50 Health and Wellness Show. I'm your host, Kevin English. I'm the founder of The Silver Edge, and our mission is to help you build and maintain a lean, healthy body that you love for the rest of your life so that you can show up in the second half of your life as the healthiest, strongest, most vital version of yourself. We have a great show for you today. Dr. Paul Kolodzic is here, and he's going to help us optimize our metabolic health so that we can be lean, strong, healthy, and vital at any age. No matter where you are on your healthy aging journey, today's episode is sure to inform and inspire you. Today's podcast is brought to you by Legion Athletics. Legion makes supplements with all of the good stuff, like all natural ingredients and clinically effective doses, without any of the gimmicks like proprietary blends or hype. Look, here's the deal. You do not need supplements to build muscle, lose fat, or get healthy. But the right supplements can definitely help. I personally love their whey protein powders, as well as their pre-workout called Pulse. And you folks can learn more by heading over to SilverEdgePartners.com and click on the Legion icon, and make sure you use coupon code SILVEREDGE to save 20% off your first order or double loyalty points on your future orders. Again, that's SilverEdgePartners.com, and be sure to use coupon code SILVEREDGE. That's SILVEREDGE, no spaces, all run together. Okay, let's get on with today's show. Today's guest is Dr. Paul Kolodzic. Dr. Paul is a physician who is dual board certified in both preventative medicine and emergency medicine. With over two decades in emergency care, Dr. Paul has witnessed the limitations of conventional medical approaches, fueling his shift towards metabolic health. In his practice, he utilizes continuous glucose monitoring to guide patients towards effective weight loss and improved metabolic health, emphasizing low-carb diets, intermittent fasting, and cautious use of weight loss medications to avoid their potential downsides. He's the author of The Continuous Glucose Monitoring Revolution, and today he's going to share his innovative approach to reversing metabolic diseases such as prediabetes and hypertension. He's a graduate of the University of Notre Dame and Wright State University, where he was chief resident. Dr. Paul is also a founding member of the Society of Metabolic Health Practitioners, advocating for a preventative approach to healthcare. I started our interview today by asking Dr. Paul how he first became interested in medicine.
My interest in medicine started with my grandfather, who was an old country doc in the 30s and 40s in rural Ohio. So, you know, I learned a little bit from him. He actually died when I was pretty young, but I retained an interest in medicine and then decided after medical school to become an emergency physician. So emergency medicine was actually just evolving at that time. Previously, emergency departments had been staffed primarily by primary care docs or even surgeons on their day off. So emergency medicine was a new thing, and I have enjoyed that over the course of the last 35 years. But what I learned over that period of time is, even though gunshot wounds and overdoses and multiple traumas get all the press out of the emergency department, what we see day in and day out is vascular disease. So that is the heart attacks, the strokes, the peripheral vascular disease, the diabetic emergencies, the diabetic renal failure. And so about 7 years, I decided to change from being reactive in the emergency department dealing with the crises to see what we could do about preventing those crises.
Fantastic. All right. That is a perfect springboard for where we want to go here. Going from that, it's too late to really help them with the preventative side once they end up in the emergency room, right? With these, you know, these lifestyle diseases that
Yeah, I'm going to say even
then it's not too late. If people begin to understand, I mean, you can have a crisis, you can get pulled back from the edge. You can even have, you know, a bad outcome. It can be looked at as a learning experience because I know a lot of people that have had crises and then decided to get serious about things. So, you know, one thing I like people to know is that they are empowered. You have the power to manage your future health. And so I didn't mean to interrupt you or correct you.
No, I love that.
It's never too late.
Never too late. We say that on the show all the time. It's never too late. Look, my story with how I got into this was I was in the emergency room. I met a doc like you, I'm sure. And that, for me, that was the turning point in my life. So well spoken. Thank you for that. So, I mean, I can't tell really from looking through here, but you look like you might be a pretty fit dude, maybe even in my age bracket. What has your journey been personally in terms of taking care of your body? And have you always been fit, or is that something you found later in life?
I never was super overweight. I was probably about 20 pounds overweight, and it had to do with just life, like it is for most, you know, middle-aged Americans. And that is trying to balance work and trying to, you know, manage kids and running kids all around. And I got to say, I did have an influence. My kids influenced me, just like my patients influenced me a lot. My kids did too. I had two boys that wrestled, and, you know, I saw how focused they were and what they were doing with their diet. And then, you know, I'm sitting at the end of the dinner table, 20 pounds overweight, and I'm thinking, you know, I should get serious about this too. So I did. And quite honestly, that model, not that everybody has to be an athlete, but that model of trying to achieve good muscle mass, lean muscle mass, I think is a good model for everybody because it integrates right into the issue of insulin resistance as well, which is, of course, you've talked about on your show and is the reason for most middle-aged Americans being overweight.
Yeah. Okay. So we've teed this up perfectly here. All right. I want to dive into all of that, pull that apart and have some fun with that. Before we get there, though, let's set some groundwork. Let's define some vocabulary. When we say metabolism, what are we talking about?
You know, metabolism is simply the taking in of energy and its expenditure. It's really what you do with the food coming into your mouth and how that energy is eventually expended. But there can be a lot of different pathways as to how that what the energy source is and how it is utilized. But at its simplest meaning, metabolism simply means the utilization of energy.
Right. Utilization of energy. And that energy, in this case, is going to be food, right? And then it's going to be broken down and we're going to use it for energy. And now, and this is kind of a loaded question, but let's talk about what do we mean when we say metabolic health or metabolically healthy? And then maybe after that, we'll segue into what do we mean when we say metabolically unhealthy or what is metabolic syndrome? But let's start with what does it mean to be metabolically healthy? And why would we say it that way if you're just saying, well, this is the food you eat and how it's broken down and creates energy? What does it mean to be metabolically healthy?
Well, it just has to do with the food you eat and what those energy sources are. And I believe the natural state of the body is not to be flushed with blood glucose all the time. It's really to be able to utilize fat as a source of energy, as our ancestors did. They would go out and kill a woolly mammoth, and they would eat the meat, and they would eat the fat. Agriculture came in a little bit later, and then sometimes the hunt would be good, and sometimes it wouldn't be good, and they would fast, if you will. And I really think, you know, that developed over millions of years. And I believe that is our natural state. And that, of course, has changed actually exponentially, aggressively since the food pyramid came out in the 70s. Everything's kind of been turned on its head, I think, to some degree, unnaturally. You know, with agriculture, we were taking in more plant-based food and we were eating more carbs. But things really accelerated in terms of our carb intake back in the 70s after the food pyramid came out. And I'm going to mention, and of course, the food pyramid came out and then the epidemic of obesity happened. And then 10 years after that, the epidemic of diabetes occurred, just as you would expect, because obese individuals become diabetic because of the way they process sugar and what happens with their insulin. And now we're seeing the fruits of that with the increased incidence of vascular disease.
Right. So I think most of us in our age demographic, the 50s and 60s, we remember in the 70s, the standard foods pyramid, if I remember correctly, that bottom layer said eat I think it was 8 to 12 servings of cereals and grains.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, man, that did not serve us so well in the long run, right? All right. We'll come back to that, I'm sure. But before we get there, people may have heard the term, you know, they may think that their metabolism is broken, or they may have heard that a slow metabolism is less desirable than a fast metabolism. They even have heard the term metabolic syndrome. Some people listening may have metabolic syndrome. Talk to us about what it means to be metabolically unhealthy, and what is metabolic syndrome?
So the term metabolic syndrome relates to having a constellation of parameters, which is usually increased weight, increased central body mass, increased waistline, high blood sugar, hypertension, and high cholesterol. And with 60% of American adults being overweight, there's a large number of people that have metabolic syndrome. And of course, metabolic syndrome leads to disease, the vascular disease that we just talked about, and then other probably not quite as serious problems, but bothersome problems, fatty liver disease, sleep apnea, gastroesophageal reflux. So that really is the basis for it, really the majority of common chronic diseases in our country.
All right. And then Dr. Paul, what would you say to somebody who says, oh man, it's just not in my genes. I got crappy. I lost the genetic lottery. What role does, and folks on YouTube are seeing your reaction right now, folks in podcast land, not so much, but what is the role then of genetics when we're talking about this metabolic syndrome or metabolic diseases?
Yeah, genetics play a role, but I think people, again, have more power than they think they have. And I think, you know, we've been taught with this increased carb diet that's almost our natural state. You look at a movie from the 40s or 50s or some photographs from the 40s or 50s, you know, the same genetics were in your family line back then, but those people weren't necessarily overweight and having metabolic disease. So I just think that being overweight has become, unfortunately, somewhat standard. And we can blame a lot of it on genetics, but people have more power than they think they have. And that's really part of my passion right now is to educate people. You know, we've been led down this path, and I won't get into too many theories here, conspiracy theories here about what
you
happened.
If I can help it, you will, but go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll put on my tinfoil hat if you will.
Well, yeah. You know, we were misled. Then I'm going to go ahead. We were misled by the U.S. Department of Agriculture with the food pyramid, and that just didn't happen. Right. I mean, there were, you know, and we don't need to go in the entire history with Ansel Keys and all that, but basically there was reason for that. And it was that the processed food industry jumped on board because foods made with seed oil and processed wheat and sugar are both have a long shelf life and are preferable. Actually, I read an article just in the last week that says, is processed food fattening? And the answer was, yeah, for the food processor's bottom line, it's fattening.
Mm-hmm. But shareholders,
So we've just been kind of led down that road, and we were told to embrace the food pyramid, and the pharmaceutical industry jumped on board when cholesterol became public enemy number one. When quite honestly, I think blood sugar is public enemy number one. In fact, I'm thinking about trying to coin a phrase that is blood glucose is the new cholesterol, because I really believe it is. And so we've been led down this path. And if we step back and think about a low carb diet really being a traditional American diet, it's really just going back to the way your grandparents ate and their grandparents before them, then you have control. So yeah, there's some genetic involvement, but this conspiracy theory is really, there's some reality to it here.
There certainly is some reality. And I've said this on the show before, right? I don't believe there's an evil cabal of rich white men somewhere wringing their hands in glee over this situation. But you can't help notice that there is a very ugly financial reality between big food, big medicine, big pharma, one making us sick, the other working very hard to treat preventable diseases, which is odd, right? But to your point, we've got these lifestyle diseases. These food companies have made these ultra palatable foods. Let's face it, they're delicious, right? There's a reason why people buy Pop-Tarts and all this stuff, right? They've got PhD scientists creating these ultra palatable foods, and they're convenient, right? To get raw, to shop for raw foods, to bring them into my home and to prepare them and cook them the way, again, our grandparents did, is a bit more work. So we've just got this perfect storm, if you will, for really ill metabolic health, it seems to me. And we're going to spend, I guess, the rest of our time here talking about how do we as individuals, like you said earlier, take back the ownership of our health and really be our own healthcare advocates here. So Dr. Paul, before we just dive down into the weeds even more here, I want to talk about what is the prevalence of, let's say, metabolic syndrome. I heard a statistic, I think it's, what is it? 1 out of 3 adults over 50 have at least one of those metabolic, you know, the overweight, the high blood pressure, high blood sugar, et cetera. And some other number has complete full-blown metabolic syndrome, which I believe is 3 of those things combined. What is the prevalence there?
Well, so 60% of Americans are overweight. The prevalence number I like to focus on is pre-diabetes and diabetes. So there's about 12% of American adults that are diabetic. Some of them don't know they're diabetic. And I know that for a fact because people come into my office, they just want to lose a few pounds. And after using the continuous glucose monitor and checking a fasting insulin level, we find out they're insulin resistant and even diabetic. The pre-diabetes number is the scariest number. 30% of American adults are pre-diabetic, and half of those people don't know this. And I'm going to actually revisit the conspiracy theory approach. And again, I don't think this is evil intent. Just like with the food processors, it's not evil intent. It's just capitalism and the profit model. Same with the pharmaceutical companies and pushing statins for cholesterol. But the same thing has happened in medicine as well. When I was getting out of my residency, a lot of docs were just hanging out their own shingle or joining small groups. And now most physicians work for large healthcare systems. Some of them work for public entities, publicly traded companies, even private equity groups. And primary care docs, I believe, are the backbone of American medicine. But they've been relegated to disease management. They've been relegated to a schedule where they only get 20 minutes of patients. And the best they can do during that time is try and control your diabetes or you know, tweak your medicines or talk about what we're going to do with your hypertension in terms of the next medication regimen. So it's really that confluence of food processing industry and the pharmaceutical industry and what's progressed with healthcare in this country and how it's delivered. We've got a model of disease management, not a model of prevention. Prevention doesn't pay. Reversing disease really doesn't pay very well. No. You know, if you need a new hip because of your obesity or you need a bypass, then the insurance companies will pay pretty well for that. And that's what the health systems have gravitated toward naturally.
Yeah. And it really is unfortunate. Big pharma we're cash cows when we just buy into the standard American diet and a sedentary lifestyle, because we will be on, say, for example, a statin for the rest of our life. We will be on blood pressure medicines for the rest of our lives. And that's a pretty good gig if you're a pharma exec or you're a pharma shareholder, right? Not so good if you're a human being trying to be healthy and vital in your 50s, 60s and beyond there. Now, so a couple of things I want to pick apart here. You mentioned, hey, you know, certainly those of us in this age bracket, cholesterol is absolutely enemy number one, right? In the 70s, it was fat is bad. And of course, by association, red meat will clog up your heart and you'll have a heart attack, right? I want to deep dive into the blood sugar insulin. But before we go there, it seems to me that our thoughts around cholesterol seem to be shifting a little bit. Certainly, it was public enemy number one, 70s, 80s, maybe even 90s. But some of the thinking and research that I'm reading as a layperson seems to me that paradigm is shifting a little bit. Can you talk a little bit about what the latest research says about cholesterol?
Well, the problem is the emphasis has been primarily on total cholesterol and total LDL, what is, you know, a subcomponent of that. And I think the newer data is showing that it really depends upon what type of LDL you had. I'm not sure this is where you were going, but basically, There are multiple types of LDL, but there are 2 major types. And I don't know if you've talked about it on your show, but there's the LDL LP called LP little a. So that is the little ping pong. This is the way it's always explained is this way, the little ping pong ball type of cholesterol. And then there was another subfraction in your total LDL, which is the large fluffy cholesterol, much less damaging. The easy way to think about this is that if the ping pong balls are banging off the intima of your vessels, the lining of your blood vessels, they're causing damage. But the large fluffy ones don't do that. So I think the major evolution that's taking place regarding cholesterol treatment is that we need to look a little bit deeper. And I have all my patients that have any concern about cholesterol. First of all, if their cholesterol is up a little bit and they've got a high blood sugar and insulin resistance, it's like the blood sugar and the insulin resistance issue is like way, way more important to them. Now, if they have a significant elevation in their cholesterol, you know, I'm not a complete disbeliever that cholesterol isn't important. So I get their subfractions done. We look at what their breakdown is, you know, and if they've got the dangerous type of cholesterol subunit LDLs, then I send them to a lipid expert and we talk about that. But it's usually in the context of, you know, public enemy number one here is your blood sugar, because anytime your blood sugar is above 140, you're getting inflammation of your vascular linings. So that needs to be the priority, but we can look at the whole picture here and make sure that your cholesterol is being managed as optimally as it can be in the context of your low carb, high fat diet.
Gotcha. Okay. We're going to pull apart some of that, I'm sure, as we go forward. All right. Let's talk about blood sugar and insulin resistance. And I guess before we go there, we had mentioned 12% diabetic. What did you say? 30% of adults pre-diabetic. Half of those don't know that. What defines whether someone is pre-diabetic? Is that a A1C count, or how do we define that?
Yeah, so the standard evaluation is a fasting blood sugar. Fasting blood sugar over 100 is pre-diabetic. Fasting blood sugar over 125 is diabetic. Or you can hang your hat on an A1C. A1C is simply the number of glucose molecules that are attached to the hemoglobin in your red blood cells. So it's literally a percentage. So if your percentage of hemoglobin A1C is 5.2, then that means 5.2% of your hemoglobin molecules have red blood cells attached to it. I want to point out here that just like glucose is attaches to red blood cells, it also attaches to your artery linings. It also attaches to your cartilage in your joints, causing joint inflammation. But those are the criteria for prediabetes and diabetes. So the cutoff actually of A1C is 5.5. Above that is prediabetic. And if you're above 6.5, you are diabetic. Now, I like to also look, which I think is one of the most important tests that should be done by anybody who's overweight or has prediabetes in their family. I like to look at fasting insulin levels, because this will drill down to your exact level of insulin resistance. You can have insulin resistance 5 years before you're even pre-diabetic. And I'm also going to interject, we talked about the way the healthcare system is set up. You know, these folks got 20 minutes in their office with you once every 6 months or a year. And if you hear this term, which occurs all the time, your blood sugar is a little bit high, we'll check it again next time. Then really what that means is you're pre-diabetic or you're almost pre-diabetic. So pay attention to that. And again, I'm not bashing the primary care docs. They do a great job. They're swimming upstream in a difficult system, but they have a tendency with those kind of issues to kick the can down the road a little bit. And that is the time right then when I think lights and sirens should be going off, because you can reverse your pre-diabetes and prevent yourself ever from progressing to diabetes. So that's the time to look at it.
All right. So let's jump into this a little bit, because then we'll pick apart how do we do that? How do we reverse this? So when we talk about elevated blood sugar and insulin resistance, without getting too far down into the weeds and too geeky here, what are we talking about? How is this happening? I mean, we've kind of set the stage. Well, we got these carbs are kind of the villain here, but what's really happening inside my body that's causing me then to have this elevated blood sugar or this insulin, the subsequent insulin resistance?
Right. I think everybody understands when you eat sugar, it becomes blood sugar in your system. But people don't understand that complex carbohydrates do the same thing. There's some infographics by a doctor over in England, David Unwin, and he equates that if you have a bowl of cereal, it's equivalent to 9 teaspoons of sugar, because as soon as that carbohydrate is broken down and passes through the gut wall, it becomes sugar. So the simple physiology is, and again, I'll try not to get too wonky, but it's just you eat a carb, whether it's a sugar or a complex carb, you know, sweet potato, rice, pasta, whatever, it becomes sugar in your system. Your sugar goes up, the pancreas releases insulin. That's its job. And insulin is the key in the lock of your organs to drive that blood sugar into your organs. And when I say organs, let's think of muscles, because it's, you know, the easiest way to think about this and come back to why increasing your muscle mass can help with insulin resistance. So far, so good. Your muscles need to contract so you have that energy. But since we switched to this high carb diet, our blood sugars are high for long periods of time. And blood sugar, as we've talked about, is toxic. It inflames your arteries and it can cause all kinds of problems in your body. So something has to happen with that blood sugar. The extra blood sugar that can't be absorbed because there's too much blood sugar around then goes to the liver, gets converted to fat. And that's why we gain fat around the middle, why we get fatty liver disease. So what insulin resistance is those organs saying, we've got all the energy we need. There's all kinds of blood glucose around. There's been all kinds of blood glucose around, and we've stored it in our organs as a complex molecule called glycogen. We don't need any more blood sugar. So insulin resistance is those organs saying, insulin, stop. We are not going to listen to you anymore. We are not going to take in any more blood sugar. And that's when, you know, it goes to the center part of our body. Low-carb diets, which I'm a huge advocate of, are just reverse that process. Lower the amount of blood sugar in your system. Pretty soon those organs are saying, you know, hey, we need more energy here. The blood sugar is too low. Give us more energy. But, you know, you're on a low-carb diet, so your blood sugar's lower. And then what happens is you have to find another source of energy. And then you look down around the middle, and there is that fat that can be broken down into fatty acids. That's going to be your source of energy. If you carry that to an aggressive approach, that produces ketones. That's where the keto diet came from. And so really, you're just reversing that process of laying down fat, and now you're breaking up fat. And the analogy I use is the bear in winter, laying down a lot of fat in the fall with the roots and the berries, and then it sleeps for 5 months, and it lives off fat. It's in ketosis during that time. We, you know, in America generally have food at our fingertips 24/7. So we don't do that. So the way to kind of replicate what our ancestors did when there was a famine or the hunt wasn't so good, or what the bears doing during winter, is low carb and intermittent fasting.
All right. So there's a bunch in there we can unpack. So basically, evolutionarily, we are hardwired to be fat storing machines for all the obvious reasons, right? There would have been food scarcity. There would have literally been likely feast or famine. And unfortunately, technology has just evolved so rapidly in such a compressed time period that we've almost we can't escape that biological hardwiring that we have to just this predilection to preferentially store fat. We probably have a good evolutionary reason why we would crave sugars. And when I say sugars, I mean just these simple carbs, complex carbs, just these carbs in general, because that would have been the most immediate source of fuel for our bodies. It's our body's preferred source of fuel. Once upon a time, that would have been a good thing because we probably would have used most of that. But today we're sedentary. Today there is no, for most of us, thankfully, food scarcity. In fact, there's food abundance, and the food that is abundant is nutrient poor and just full of crap, basically carbs, sugars. And we've got this this perfect storm again where we're destined to store fat. So you have mentioned a couple things there, low carb and intermittent fasting. And when we say low carb, and of course, we're going to push keto aside, the full-on ketosis, what in the standard American diet, roughly how many carbs would a person be consuming in a day?
You know, generally 250, 300, 350.
And that's a lot of carbs.
It wasn't always that way. We you know, when the food pyramid came out, we went from 25% carbs in our diet to 50% carbs in our diet.
Okay, there's a good illustration. Now, another thing I want to point out is that high carb would be great if you're an athlete. If you're a high performance, say you're a CrossFit athlete or one of these some kind of maniac athlete, you probably are using all those carbs. So the problem may not so much be carbs as our, or in combination, I suppose, we have this, now this, the bulk of our diet is carbohydrate, and we've got the sedentary lifestyle. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that is fair.
Okay. Now, talk to me about intermittent fasting. I'm yet to be sold on intermittent fasting, specifically for weight loss and for a couple of reasons, but I'd love to hear, you know, I've certainly heard the evolution. Well, once upon a time, we would have gone with fasting. And I'm like, well, we kind of have fasting baked into our biology. It's called sleep. And if you stop eating after dinner and you don't eat until the next morning, you probably got 10 to 12 hours. And that's kind of intermittent fasting. But are you talking about intermittent fasting in the, hey, eat in the 6 hour window, or more, you know, I personally don't do this for health reasons, but I fast at least one day of a month. I just do a 24-hour fast. What, when you say intermittent fasting, what are you talking about and specifically why?
Yeah. So usually I'm just talking about that, a prolonged period overnight, 12 hours, 14 hours. Some of my patients do 16 hours. I don't think you have to do 24 or 36 hour fasts. I just think you need a period of time where, you know, you're depriving your body of food. And the main reason I'm a proponent of intermittent fasting is because, other than a low carb diet, it's the most effective way to lower your insulin level. Mm. And for most middle-aged, overweight Americans, insulin resistance, this physiology that we just talked about, where the pancreas keeps putting out insulin because it doesn't get the message from the organs that they've got plenty of blood glucose, the issue is insulin resistance. So the reason I'm a proponent of moderate intermittent fasting is because, after a low-carb diet, it's the most effective way to lower insulin resistance. And for people that are interested in both controlling their blood sugar and losing weight, it really is an effective and important component of the regimen.
Okay. So moderate, meaning again, that if you're doing 12, 14 hours of fasting, which a lot of us, if you're not, of course, those of us that eat our dinner and then snack well on into the night, or perhaps even worse, have some alcoholic drinks maybe after dinner, but if I stop eating after dinner, say at 6 or 7 p.m., and I eat my next meal at 6, 7 the next morning, I'd probably fall in that healthy guideline. All right. You had mentioned earlier, we can reverse insulin resistance. We can reverse prediabetes. We can reverse high blood sugar. And clearly, one of the ways we can do that is to cut carbs and intermittent fast, like you just mentioned. When you say cut carbs or reduce carbs or go low carb, we'd mentioned, okay, 250 to 350 is pretty much the standard American diet, what we're currently eating. Are we cutting that in half? Are we cutting that in a quarter? Are we?
I usually push my patients toward about 50 grams of carbs a day. And I'll tell
50
you,
grams of carbs. Okay.
50 grams of carbs a day. And if they're interested in weight loss, which, you know, I have a selected population, people that come to me, if they're interested in weight loss, I have found that it's easier just to rip the Band-Aid off. That means, you know, go initially to 75 or 50 grams of carbs. Quite honestly, it's very doable once people understand this. I really don't have a lot of patients that struggle getting there. Once they understand the process, they learn how to count their macronutrients, you know, the three macronutrients being carbs, fat, and protein. So we generally aim for 50 grams of carbs or less. And the thing that they hear from me, which is novel in comparison to other medical providers they've been to, is that, you know, I care about you keeping your carbs low. And this is, you know, usually in the context of having measured their insulin levels and have them worn a continuous glucose monitor for a period of a couple of weeks. So we have a really good handle on what's going on with their insulin and blood sugar metabolism. But usually what I say to them, let's keep your carbs low. Let's get adequate protein, because the third component of the stool after low carb and intermittent fasting is strength training, because it decreases insulin resistance as well. So I tell them, let's keep your carbs low. Let's get adequate protein. I'm not going to worry about your fat intake that much, which of course is the antithesis of what they've been hearing since they were 10 years old. But we talk about good fats and bad fats, you know, seed oils being bad fats, fried fast food being bad fats because they're cooked in seed oil. But I don't focus as much on fats. Let's get the carbs under control. Let's get the protein up. And usually those patients end up doing real well.
All right. Well, certainly we talk a lot on this show about that third leg of your stool there, the protein and the muscle and the strength up. But I want to go back to that low carb. So 50 grams of carbs is pretty low. Do you find, and here's where my nutrition coaching hat comes on, because not only does it have to be healthy, it's got to be doable. So when people come up with, you know, with like, that's why I don't really like keto. Does keto have a place? Absolutely. But most people aren't going to do that for the rest of their life. Same thing with some of these crazy eating windows. I only eat in 4 hours a window. What do you enjoy that? And can you do that for the rest of your life? Probably not.
Yeah.
And same thing at 50 grams of carbs a day. Is there an allowance for somebody like me who's not overweight, is rather active? Does my allowance go up?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. When I have patients that are overweight that come to me, and once they start reaching their goals and getting their weight into the range that they want, then it absolutely goes up. But again, people usually don't come to me initially. People like you don't initially come to me.
I don't want, no offense, I don't want to be your patient. Yeah.
I get it. And you don't need to be, but they come to me for a reason. And so, there's a sliding scale there. Okay. You know, once they start getting to their goals, we can move on up with that. Yeah. If they're doing additional strength training, we need to liberalize the carbs a little bit in addition to the protein, then we go ahead and do that. So it can be managed, but I do find initially for people that are overweight, have insulin resistance, want to lose significant weight, need their insulin resistance reversed for their own health, getting to that 50 number is usually a good thing. And I'll be honest with you, people don't have a lot of problems with it. Really, once they understand the physiology. And the other thing that's going on here, which I'm sure we'll get into, is the use of the continuous glucose monitors. And because what I do is I put a continuous glucose monitor, those are those devices you see on the back of the arms of diabetics, initially used for insulin administration to dose your insulin correctly. But you put a CGM on a patient that has some insulin resistance, and I tell them to then go about their normal diet for the next 2 weeks. Don't change anything. Let's just see where you live in terms of what's going on with your blood sugar metabolism. And once they see that, because for the majority of patients, they see these spikes go up, they see it down, they see an elevated level of blood sugar.
In real once time, they see by the way, that, right?
Yeah, real time, in real time. And I can, Big Brother can be watching because I can look at your data remotely too. They understand once they see that. And so quite honestly, 50 grams isn't that onerous, because they realize that if they want to get where they need to be, they got to get rid of those spikes and they got to get that average down. And they become exceptionally motivated once they view that piece of data. The way my patients have put it is, once I've seen that, I can't unsee it. Once I know what a donut or a piece of pizza did to me, I can't unsee it. And they self-correct. And this is why, if I may, why I think low carb is a sustainable lifestyle. I'm not a calories in, calories out person in terms of people trying to lose weight. That's the energy balance model of weight loss. I do not think that's sustainable for a lifetime. I think history has shown that. But with a low carb approach, you can always eat something. And I tell my patients that, you're hungry, go eat something. We need to manage the number of carbs you're eating, but you can always eat something.
All right. So So if folks don't know, if you're not a nutrition nerd, you may not know this, but there's really two kind of camps in the whole weight loss. And there's this insulin resistant blood sugar. And then there's the energy balance. Energy balance is what it sounds like. If I eat less energy than I burn, then I'm going to lose weight. So I want to kind of pull some of this apart here, because this is fascinating to me. In order to lose weight, is it a true statement to say that I need to be in a calorie deficit? Yeah, and I'm saying this intentionally because this is a nuanced conversation, right?
Yeah.
This is not as black as white as most people think. Yeah. So I'm setting you up here.
Yeah.
But do I need to be in a calorie deficit in order to make the scale weight go down?
Yeah. My belief is that weight loss is more complex than just two numbers, the number of calories you take in and the number of calories you burn out. It's a hormonal issue, and the star hormone is insulin. So I do not, calorie deficit is one way to get there. I don't think it's the only way to get there, and I don't think it's the most effective way to get there.
And so we In our coaching practice, we talk about this so much, we see a higher incident of this than maybe the general population. But we talk a lot to people that are chronic dieters, people that are chronically under eating. And it may sound odd for me to say this person is overweight and under eating, but we'll get people into our program. Let's just say, take a fictitious example, Mrs. Smith, she's 55 years old. Let's say she's doing Weight Watchers. She's got a point system. We ask her to measure and track everything she eats for a couple of weeks. And lo and behold, she's eating 1,100 calories. Now, one theory says I can get her to lose weight by asking her to eat less food. But if you're, let's just say she's 20 pounds overweight and she weighs, she's a 150-pound woman, asking her to eat 800 calories, 700 calories, whatever, and that calorie deficit is not only just a ridiculous thing to ask an adult human being to do, it's unhealthy. And that's digging this metabolic hole really, really deep that she's going to have to later climb out for. And that's why I just wanted to use that as an example, because you said energy balance, I believe your words were, it's not sustainable. And I know that there are some pretty hardcore camps that are going to sound clip that and say, you're crazy. But that's why. Because that whole prescription of eat less and move more for weight loss it's oversimplified and it's flawed. And now as we get into these more nuanced discussions about if I can get you strong and healthy, and if I can change what you eat less than how much you eat, I've got a much healthier prescription for getting you where you want to go. Now, the trade-off might be it takes a longer time. Is that fair?
Maybe? I'm not so sure about that because, if you have somebody
that's hard to work. Because you can lose a crazy amount of weight.
Yeah,
it's going to be really unhealthy, and you're going to rebound, right?
Yeah. I mean, the answer is yes. Yeah, now that I think about it, the answer is yes. But again, short term gain, but not sustainable long term. I don't believe. And I think you said it earlier. Your body wants you to be fat. When you get in an energy deficit situation, your body's saying no. I got to get ready for the famine. I got to get ready for the bad hunt. I got to hang on to this adipose tissue here as hard as I can. When you're low carb, increased fat, you don't have to do that. The other thing I'm going to throw in here is increased fat. Fat causes satiety. It's nature's original Ozempic. What happens is when you eat fat, food stays in your stomach for a longer period of time. You have a brain sensation of satiety. So you end up eating less. So that's another advantage of low carb, higher fat.
The way in our practice, the way we get around that, we don't necessarily start people out by reducing carbs. We say eat more protein.
Yeah, sure.
And that, because it you made me think of that when you said fat has this high satiety. Well, so does protein. Eating more protein certainly does. I want to circle back on protein and muscle, but just kind of back to this. You had mentioned that, hey, when we're in this low calorie state, our body's kind of in this state of alarm, right? And I think about all the people that follow that, well, just move more and eat less, that go into a calorie deficit when they have no business starting a diet from where they are, but they, that's what they're going to do. And then they, on top of that, they're going to throw in a bunch of probably cardio, right? They're going to go do a bunch of classes a week, or they're going to get on like a hamster and get on that treadmill and go, 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 go. Yeah. And I think what happens there is they probably initially are going to see some weight loss, but the body is really, really good at finding the stasis, and it's going to start shutting down some not so critical, yet critical systems, like your reproductive system, for example, in an effort to try and it's going to cling even more tightly to the fat that you're so desperately trying to get rid of. Is that a fair illustration? That's a very unscientific way.
I agree with that.
The body doesn't want to get rid of the fat in that state, does it? Because it's perceiving emergency.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've used this phrase on your show or not, but the phrase is you can't outrun your fork. You can't burn enough calories to outrun what you eat. And then this gets into the differentiation between the strength training camp and the cardiovascular camp. And I know, in modern times, which means the last 20 years or so, the high intensity interval training has taken over as kind of a mix of those two. But in addition to my patients hearing from me, I'm not going to worry about your fat that much. The other kind of the thing they hear from me that is certainly not mainstream is I want you really focusing on strength training much more than you're focusing on cardiovascular. And from an insulin resistance standpoint, this is the reason. When you increase your muscle mass, you increase the quality and the receptivity of the insulin receptors on your muscles. They soak up more insulin, they soak up more blood glucose, and they help lower, it helps lower your insulin resistance. And until you get your insulin resistance under control, it's increasingly difficult to lose weight. So that's really a number, the numbers that we want to attack. So again, I tell people, you know, I'm not a complete non-believer related to cardiovascular training. In fact, what I tell my patients is I want you to follow the American Heart Association guidelines. In the American Heart Association guidelines for cardiovascular fitness, and I'm sure you know these, 75 minutes a week at 80 or 85% of your heart rate max, or 150 minutes a week at 65% of your heart rate max. So I ask them to do that. I tell them to have a preference to do more intense short workouts, because then they only have to spend 75 minutes. And for the typical person that has 3-4 hours a week to work out, then you can spend the rest of that time strength training. So you're meeting the AHA guidelines, plus you're getting what I feel is the more important strength training in. And then I'm also going to throw in, and your listeners know this, we're all swimming upstream as we get older. And I don't know what numbers you've heard, but you know, in general, you're losing 70% of your muscle mass each decade as you age. For women and even men, the osteoporosis issue becomes huge, because the bigger your muscle mass is, the more stress you're putting on your skeletal structure, which is going to help you retain more calcium. So there's lots of reasons, especially for middle-aged and older people, strength training should be emphasized.
Amen, brother. Yeah, we preach that all the time on the show. Yeah. We've had Dr. Gabriel Lyon on the show. I'm guessing you probably know who she is, but she's famous now with her new book, but she is famous for saying muscle is the organ of longevity, and making statements like where we have less of a problem with being over fat than we do with being under muscled. Certainly that speaks to all the kind of skinny fat condition, as well as just, you know, overweight and obesity as well. But we're big, big fans. And I think that gets lost as we come into our 50s and 60s. Especially in our female population. You referenced earlier kind of the cardio thing. And of course, in the 70s, it was for ladies, workout meant get your leggings on and let's follow Jane Fonda along in this aerobics class. And at least the ladies that come into our program, 100%, it's a requirement that you do some form of traditional strength training. That we meet people where they are. That doesn't mean everybody is barbell back squatting and deadlifting day one, but certainly some sort of resistance training, which to be clear means weight training, like a bodybuilder, like you're probably thinking.
Well, you're right. Bands, Pilates,
body weight, all of it with progressive overload, professionally, age-appropriate design. By age-appropriate, by the way, I don't mean necessarily little pink dumbbells or quarter squats. I mean functional, real-life movements, getting stronger in a full range of motion. Being able to express that in the real world is so critical. And when I first started doing this, it was more for the aesthetic side of things, right? People were coming because they wanted to lose weight. I was like, well, man, if I can just get these old people to eat some damn protein and lift some damn weights, the weight's going to fall off them. And it was a formula I stumbled on and it worked. And then all of a sudden, lo and behold, I'm learning, you know, I'm following people like you and I'm learning, oh, wait, there's all these other reasons why that might be a good idea, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's something that kind of gets lost. You had mentioned sarcopenia and osteopenia. And this is this age-related muscle loss, age-related bone density loss. And it turns out that's less age-related and more lifestyle-related, right? Just because, you know, somewhere along the line, we stop. The body's not going to hang on to muscle, especially that metabolically expensive type 2 muscle that is so metabolically advantageous for us if we don't have a reason to have it around, right? Because it is metabolically expensive, meaning it burns more calories at rest and helps you maintain a healthy body composition longer, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. All right. Yeah, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here. All right.
Yeah, one thing I am going to interject is working 30 years in the emergency department, I see all kinds of patients that lose their mobility, you know, upper 70s, 80s, they lose their mobility. for no other reason than they don't have leg strength. They don't have enough muscle mass in their legs. It's not because they got a joint problem or a back problem or a neurological issue. They just do not have enough muscle mass in their legs to keep themselves upright. And I think, quite honestly, that's tragic because it's preventable.
Right.
And it integrates with, you know, the approach of make sure that you're increasing your muscle mass in the lower part of your body. 55% of our muscle mass is below our waist. So, you know, it's an old joke, but
don't skip leg day. I believe in that so much.
I do legs, you know, I give myself appropriate rest, but I try and do leg, and I don't have, you know, it's not like I'm bragging about my legs because they aren't anything, but I do it twice a week. I do some kind of legs twice a week. And I do it for that reason, because I want to hopefully be walking around when I'm 83 or 85. I don't want to be confined to a wheelchair or have, you know, to live in a nursing facility where I have assistance just because I can't get up and around. So even now, I think legs are absolutely critical.
100% with you. And for those of us in our age group, as we're preparing for becoming our parents' age, right? If we can enter that strong and capable, you had mentioned, you know, people are losing mobility, they're having falls. We all probably know how falls in. You fall and you break a hip in your 80s. It's probably not going to be a good outcome for you. But if we can enter that era strong, capable, not only is our world bigger because there's more things available to us, but we're just safer. I don't know if you know who Mark Ripito is, but he's got one of my all-time favorite sayings. That he's kind of a pretty, you either love him or hate him. He's a very polarizing figure in strength training, but he says strong people are harder to kill. And he's not talking about in a physical fight, or maybe that's part of it, but he's talking about strong people. If you're strong, if you're aging strong, you're harder to kill from all, you know, whether it's the next pandemic, whether it's a fall, whether it's whatever, right? All cause mortality. Yeah.
Yeah. And we saw that during COVID, you know.
We sure did.
The department through COVID. And, you know, people that had metabolic problems, limited muscle mass, they're even young people. They're the ones that ended up
on outcomes weren't so great. Yeah. So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk, because weight loss is what most people are chasing, right? And it's probably from a place of, they've either come and seen somebody like you who said you need to lose some weight. And if they come see someone like you, fortunately, they're going to get a good prescription. Their general practitioner, unfortunately, is probably going to say, eat less, move more, take these meds. And
I get primary care docs sending me people now. It's great.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I love that. What is really, really popular right now, and I know you've got some expertise here, so I'd really love to talk to you a little bit, is about these GLP-1, this agonist, this semi-glutide. People may know that as, what is it, Ozempic, Mounjaro, Wegovy. Yeah. So these weight loss prescription drugs, all the rage right now. Talk to us a little bit about, I'm kind of curious myself, how do these work? What's the mechanism of action? What's actually happening here?
Sure. So these medications have three mechanisms of action. One is they prolong fullness in the stomach. They slow gastric emptying. They do that by narrowing the valve between the stomach and the intestines, called the pyloric valve. So your stomach stays fuller for a longer period of time.
So it literally stays fuller.
It literally stays fuller for a longer period of time.
Gotcha.
Yeah. The second is, we've already talked about, they lower blood sugar. The reason these medications got studied for weight loss is because they lower blood sugar, but they don't cause hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia is a dangerously low blood sugar. So used first in diabetics is Ozempic and Mounjaro, a couple others, and people lose weight on them. So maybe we should look at them for weight loss. So they lower blood sugar, and what happens is you end up burning fat. They lower blood sugar, but they didn't cause hypoglycemia. And the drug company saw that, you know, these medicines don't cause hypoglycemia. And then the third one is they have a direct third mechanism of action. They have a direct hypothalamic effect. So that they actually attack the hunger center of the brain so that people are less hungry.
Okay, so that's interesting. And if folks aren't really that familiar, I don't believe you can have an interest in weight loss and not have heard at least one of those drug names, maybe not GLP-1, but certainly Wegovy or Ozempic, things like that. I think Weight Watchers actually bought the parent company, so they're tied into that now. But these drugs work, unlike I think most, I think we can safely say most of the weight loss drugs, because that's the magic bullet, right? If you can make a weight loss drug that actually works.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts then on using these for a population that's overweight?
Sure. Let me give you a couple thoughts. First of all, so I've had this practice for 7 years, and you know, before we used any of the weight loss drugs, and I am using them in a prudent manner. Now we'll talk about what prudent means. But you know, the first thing I think you need to do is build a foundation. People come in and I do CGM for 2 weeks. We haven't talked about fasting insulin levels, absolutely critical. That's part of their evaluation. And then we put this program together with low carb, intermittent fasting, and strength training. So there are people then that want to embrace the medications. And the way I talk about this is the genie is out of the bottle on these drugs. Sure. And it is not going back in.
That's a fact.
People are going to use them. Yeah. And my goal for that patient population that wants them is to have them use them correctly. Because just about everybody knows you can just go out on the internet. You can get a medical provider to throw these medicines at you. See you in 6 months. Good luck with your titrating up and titrating down. And they don't talk about the risks. The big risk being loss of muscle mass. When you lose weight, you lose muscle mass. It seems to be accelerated with these medications. So if you are not doing focus, significant strength training when you're on these medications, it's just a mistake. It's a big mistake. And then the other big one is, of course, weight regain when you come off. 60% of the weight you will lose will be regained, 60 to 70% when you come off. So if you don't have that foundation of those other things that we just talked about as built in, that you'll gain weight. And they're expensive medications. I personally don't think that somebody should come to me and I should say, you know what, we're going to start you on this medication and you're going to be on it for the next 60 years. Yeah. You know, it doesn't cause physical dependence, but it certainly causes psychological dependence. So you got to have the foundation in place. And then the way I believe they should be used, if used, and how I use them is lower doses for shorter periods of time. So I don't know, these are once weekly injections. You kind of start at one dose for the first month, and then you move up to the next dose for a month and up to the next dose for a month. I try and keep my patients at moderate, never go to high doses, keep them at moderate doses. Because the plan is, like Stephen Covey said, begin with the end in mind. What is the end in mind? The end in mind is to go ahead and titrate off them. So you want to stay away from the highest dosages. And if you're doing the other things, like we've talked about, you know, you should be able to do that. So lower doses and measure their use in a period of months and not years. So the genie's out of the bottle. People are going to seek these. People are going to use them. So I'm, okay with using them if they're used in the appropriate context. I have some patients that come to me and they want to use them out of the gate. And we talk about how you got to be doing these other things if you're going to do that. More often, it's when people start a program with me and then they hit a stall. And, you know, they hit a plateau. And we then use, the term I use is we'll sprinkle a little bit of this medicine in for a limited period of time. So that's kind of my take on the medicines.
All right. Thanks for sharing that. That is the best description I've heard of a good use. It seems to me that there's got to be a population or there's got to be a use case where these medicines can be impactful. It can be a part of a good treatment plan. Certainly what you just described sounds fantastic because again, beginning with the end in mind, which is for you not to be on this for the rest of your life. So My fear looking at this as a personal trainer and a nutrition coach is, okay, I can either, Kevin's going to tell me, I got to eat whole foods and I can't be gobbling down all this ultra processed crap and he's going to make me work out, or I can just pay for this injection I take weekly and just magically lose the weight. But to your point, you are losing weight. We've determined that these drugs are effective at that. But you're losing muscle. You're and in our age group, especially, that's tragic. And it seems to me that it's creating this kind of sense of false hope where, hey, I get this immediate drop in weight. And, you know, I've been trying probably some people their entire adult lives to lose weight. they get this drug, they lose the weight, and they're like, I'm keeping it off. This is fantastic. But to your point, the minute they stop doing that, that weight's coming back because that's what's causing, you know, you just mentioned those three things that are causing this weight loss. And it doesn't seem to me that it's making people healthy. But it does bring me to my next question, and this is just pure conjecture while I got you here. Do you think that we will see in our lifetime technology save us? In other words, to me, it seems like the way we combat this is through lifestyle change, through doing healthy things, by rejecting kind of modernity almost, but and going back to this more traditional way. I'm going to move my body. Once upon a time, we didn't have to work out because that was life.
Yeah,
we didn't have the option of eating 90% of food not being even real food, but some food-like substance.
Yeah.
Do you think that we're going to have medicines or some other technology that will make us healthy and vibrant and vital with healthy muscle that does not include us doing the work that today it takes in order to have that kind of body?
So this is a great question. And, you know, with any medical intervention, there are always risks and there are always benefits. Even with these medications, you know, they've been out, you know, 8-10 years. We don't know if there's going to be a problem for somebody that's been on it after 15 or 20 years.
Right.
So there's always risks. And I think you need to keep that in the back of your mind. This is also becoming a little bit of an ethical argument because, I mean, the argument here is discipline, working out, diet, or magic pill, injection.
That is in fact. But I think there's a good part of the population that want the magic pill and would pay dearly for it.
Right. There's a cartoon of a medical facility and there's two windows. You've seen it. Okay.
Absolutely. But go ahead and describe it for folks that don't know what you're talking about. Two windows,
One is pills and procedures and the other one is lifestyle change. And there's this huge line behind the pills and procedures window and nobody is in the lifestyle change window.
Right.
But it's going to be, I mean, society's going to face this issue. These medicines are expensive, out of pocket. If your insurance doesn't cover it, over $1,000 a month. There's a generic compounded medicines I'm going to mention that I offer where you can get them for about a third that amount that cost, but they're still expensive. But it gets down to, you know, what is the right mix here? And what is the societal burden of the cost? 60% of people overweight at $1,000 a month. I mean, we can't do that right now. And so I think the answer, you know, I'm always kind of a moderate in this approach. I think the answer is somewhere in the middle in that I don't think there's ever going to be a completely cost-effective technological or pharmaceutical resolution to this. I think the answer is in the middle, which is the way I practice now, which is let's go ahead and do the basic things you know you should be doing anyways. And then if we need limited amounts of medicine, let's go ahead and sprinkle that in, as I say.
You don't see us becoming drug-fueled cyborgs in the immediate future
There's something about for me, it's just like, you got to have some skin in the game. You got to have some personal responsibility as well.
100%. I think it's a more meaningful life. I think it's a more purpose-driven life. I think
that's a great point.
For us to have challenge that we can rise up and meet, and when we make everything just easy, this magic pill, which let's face it, most of us would take a magic pill if we could wave a magic wand and have, for example, whatever health or body we wanted. Most of us would take that and probably pay dearly for it. But okay. Just some fun there at the end of this. That's something that I'm just watching what's happening in medical advancements, and there's so much money. We're talking billions of dollars being poured into this, you know, chasing this utopian idea that we can cure preventable diseases, not cure preventable diseases, but we can treat preventable diseases with these different drugs. So be interesting to see where all that goes. Well, Dr. Paul, as we're wrapping up here, talk to us about what's next for you. I mean, you got your book out. You're a big proponent of being metabolically healthy. What are you excited about in the future?
So I'll tell you, I'm just passionate about what I'm doing in terms of, you know, one patient at a time. You know, when you experience a 19-year-old losing 60 pounds, reversing their insulin resistance, parents diabetic with complications, they're on a different path. You know, a lot of middle-aged women, for some reason, I don't know what your experience is, but sometimes the women seem to get it a little bit better than us guys. They'd rather wait for the crisis to occur before they act. But changing, changing people's lives. So I, one patient at a time, I'm going to be growing my practice. If I can make a plug, I'm a licensed in Ohio, Indiana, Florida, and Arizona. Most of our work now is by telemedicine since COVID. It's become, pretty easy for this type of practice where it's mostly guidance that's effective. We can call in the CGM scripts and get the labs done locally. And then I see patients via telemedicine. And then really just kind of to following the outline that we provide, the book is on, again, if I could plug the book, The Continuous Glucose Monitor Revolution. Last chapter in the book is CGMs are life-changing, and they really can be. As my patient said, again, once you see this, you can't unsee it. The book's on Amazon. You can get an idea of my practice and this type of program to potentially even talk with your provider in your area about pursuing this. But I think the combination of low carb, intermittent fasting, strength training, CGMs to guide that low carb, do an assessment and then guide that low carb diet, and then limited use of the medications can be very effective. And it's what I'm passionate about right now. And, we're going to stamp out insulin resistance one patient at a time here in the Midwest.
Fantastic. I absolutely love it. So tell folks how they can get in touch with you. How can they connect with you? How can they learn more?
Thanks. My website for my practice is metabolicmds.com. So the word metabolic and then mds.com. And I am on TikTok as Dr. Colo and on Twitter as dr.colo. And we've got an Instagram and you can find me on LinkedIn as well. So, I do a fair amount of social media and it's just on these types of topics and really how, I'm going to circle back to what we talked about at the beginning, how you have the power really to kind of manage your health in the future and have a healthy future. You just got to educate yourself because the world is not helping. The food processing industry and the, mainstream health care and the pharmaceutical industry is not helping you on this. So you really got to roll up your sleeves and educate yourself.
Yeah, you got to be a healthcare rebel. You got to take control of that. Absolutely. That's a great place to end on that empowering note. Folks, the book again is called The Continuous Glucose Monitor Revolution. I will put links to that as well as everything from Dr. Paul's info into the show notes. You guys can find that there. Dr. Paul, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, sharing not just your wisdom and your knowledge with us, but really your passion for this subject and the work that you do. Absolutely love it and encourage you to keep up the great work.
Well, that shows through with you, Kevin. Again, you keep up the great work as well, because I can see how passionate you are about what you're doing and also changing people's lives.
Okay, that's our show for today, folks. If you've enjoyed this podcast, I want to let you know that we have other free resources over at silveredgefree.com. There, you'll find our free guides with our top tips on nutrition, exercise, and healthy lifestyle to assist you in your weight loss and fitness journey. So feel free to head over there and download anything that looks useful to you. I'll put links to everything we talked about in the show notes. You folks can find those over at silveredgefitness.com/271. As we wrap up our time together today, you can show your support for this show in two important ways. The first is to tell a friend about this podcast and encourage them to give it a listen. The second is for you YouTube folks to please click the like and subscribe buttons, and for you podcast folks to please give this podcast a 5-star review on whatever platform you listen to podcasts on, and be sure to subscribe and follow so you don't miss any future episodes. I really appreciate you spending your time with me today, and until next time, stay strong.